Group meeting, Sunday, 13th September, 1981. I thought it might be useful to consider together very carefully the subject of meditation. The Western world has taken to it as one of their new fashions, just as they have taken to yoga as a new fashion, not realizing just precisely the extremely serious things that are involved in meditation and yoga and so forth. There are a few who are really serious about it, and they go about it the right way. And of course we are happy to have one expert in our midst on that matter. But where meditation is concerned, for me it is really sad to see what the whole world does today with regard to meditation. First of all, let us bear in mind why people take to meditation. They take to meditation because life has presented them with so many frustrations. They have suffered a great deal, and they have perhaps no peace of mind and so forth, and they think that if they take to meditation, they will have a happy life, which they would if they could meditate. They take to meditation in order to obtain some result for themselves. Now, this is the very important point we must bear in mind. Meditation is not for the purpose of entering the kingdom of heaven or nirvana. You and I and any existential being, that is the psychophysical person, will never enter into nirvana or the kingdom of heaven. We shall simply die as existential beings. But insofar as we, here and now, live that kind of religious life which enables the complete purification and therefore the full flowering of the whole psychophysical being to take place, if that is done, then nirvana and the kingdom of heaven or the light of transcendence or whatever you like to call it will shine through each and every one of us. And that is what we must carefully bear in mind. This is not for our benefit or for the glory of man. It is for the glory of God, to put it in straightforward theistic terms. It is the transcendent which reaps the fruit of all that is sown by individual human beings. Individual human beings also reap a tiny fraction of that fruit, but no more. For the very simple reason that no one individual being is the sole agent responsible for any thought and feeling, for any word or any action. So many other people, so many other forces, circumstances, conditions, situations, they are all involved in every single manifestation of the total effect, the total karmic effect of all these influences at play, in which the individual's own desire or activity is only a fraction of the total number of forces. And in the process, in the living process from birth up to death, we do experience not only the result of our own actions, if we were to put a hand into the fire, well, the hand will get burnt, but we also experience the result of the actions and thoughts and feelings of thousands of people who compose our society, in fact millions nowadays, and we bear the karma which they have generated. This sort of principle of vicariousness is a very real principle active throughout the universal process. It's an extraordinary fact. People will say, people who are particularly interested, say, in Hindu or Buddhist teaching, they say, you sowed this, that and the other cause and you shall reap the results of it. And they also quote St. Paul saying, whatsoever ye sow, that ye shall reap. St. Paul put it in a very bad form. Whatsoever is sown by you and me and all mankind, or by anything whatsoever, is reaped by all of us collectively. We can't avoid it. If you look carefully into your own lives, how often we say, oh, if so-and-so hadn't been treacherous or unfaithful to me, if so-and-so hadn't misled me, then I wouldn't have had to put up with all this trouble and difficulty that I went through. You see, everybody is involved with oneself, and everything is involved with oneself. So we have to bear that in mind. Now, similarly, with things like yoga and with meditation particularly, one has to realize that oneself is not out, must not be out to gain anything for oneself. This is of fundamental importance. Utter selfness must prevail before meditation can begin. If we think that by going through a particular set verbal ritual or a mode of devotional prayer or worship or something, we are meditating, we are entirely mistaken. It is true that it is a devotional prayer, it is an exercise in concentration, if you like, the capacity to concentrate is very useful in meditation proper. But apart from that, the ordinary things we do under the name of meditation are not meditation. Now let us start from the beginning as usual. Always start from the ABC, and the ABC is transcendence and totality themselves. That's all. That's the beginning, that's the middle, that's the end. That's the whole thing, the total reality. This primordial, undifferentiated, creative energy is identical with pure or absolute consciousness. Now, the word consciousness in English misleads us. We think of that absolute consciousness as something analogous to our consciousness. It isn't anything of the sort. But keep the word for the present. It's a useful word. The creative energy is identical with absolute consciousness. When the creative energy differentiates from its original state of vibrant quiescence, the absolute consciousness simultaneously proliferates. And in that process, grades of being come into existence. So many grades that we know nothing about them whatsoever. What we do know of the grades of being in the religions of the world have been presented in the names of the archangels and angels and so forth. And they are all cosmic influences, cosmic forces. One such archetypal expression of that process of differentiation and proliferation we can term mind. This is pure mind as such. And this is the particular type of creative energy which releases cosmos out of chaos. Another type we can name as primordial matter. Now, when we use the word matter, all we know about it is that matter is solid, liquid, gaseous. Apart from that, it is energy. We know about the energy of light, of heat, of chemical energy, electrical energy, and so forth. Those are the manifestations which are the material and the immaterial expression of this primordial creative energy, which is way and away beyond our any knowledge that human beings have up to date or can have, as long as we are human beings structured and constructed as we are, you see. Alright, so mind and matter, primordial matter. This primordial matter perhaps may have been touched now in the work done by scientists who suggest that the Big Bang was the origin of the entire universe. Now I want you to consider carefully what this implies. From their calculations, their mathematical calculations, they say that all the matter that now exists in the entire cosmos, all the galaxies and clusters of galaxies and you and I and every grain of sand and every single atom that there is and subatomic particle was all compressed into a tiny sphere of radius 1/1000th of a centimeter. Now just try and get that in your mind, if it's possible. The entire universe was concentrated in a single point of a needle. A single point of a needle is approximately, of, if you regard it as a sphere, is approximately 1/1000th of a centimeter radius. Now you see, in that state, the density of that original pinpoint, the needle point, was something colossal, 10 to the power 90 kilograms per cubic centimeter. That was the pressure, the density, and the temperature at that time, if you please, they say was 10 to the power 41 degrees centigrade. One with 41 noughts after it, degrees centigrade. We are happy and comfortable with 20 and 25, we can just endure 30, and by the time we are 40, we are frizzled to a frazzle. You see? Isn't that so? So imagine a temperature of 1 with 41 noughts after it. That was the temperature at the initial point, as they call it. They call it the initial point, and they name it the singularity. Now, from that initial point, where time begins, so to say, in the very first fraction of a second, the fraction is 1 divided by 10 to the power 43. Now we know what a second is. Tick, tock, tick, tock. Now divide any one tick by 10 to the power 43. And at that period, which is known as the Planck time, P-L-A-N-C-K, after the name of the physicist Max Planck, you see, at that moment, the Big Bang took place, and within, in less than a second, so to say, most of the universal process had already come into existence as such. See, these things are unimaginable by us. The mind absolutely boggles. But something like this could be the possibility. Now, I'm saying all this because I'd like you to consider just what is implied in that pinpoint. Now, we think of it as a particle, that the whole universe, all the matter of the universe was compressed in that pinpoint. And we'll think of it as a particle. Nothing of the sort. There is nothing solid, liquid, or gaseous about it. You see? It is pure energy compressed in that way. And of course the compression was so great it had to burst. Do you get the feel of it? Now that is the reason why I call it primordial matter, because that is the origin of the entire material universe as we see it and know it so far. So we have, from the original differentiation process, primordial, this archetypal expression which we call mind, and this archetypal form which we call matter. Out of it all, everything gradually emerged, as far as our experience of what actually is goes and tells us. You see, everything emerged from that. Now, consciousness, remember, accompanies all the different grades as they form, and they become more and more concrete as they sort of go down the line, and increasing quantities of manifestations come into being. The lowest point is touched in earth. And in the mineral, consciousness is perhaps most completely locked up, that primordial consciousness. Then starts the process of ascent through the vegetable and the animal kingdom, and in us, consciousness functions in the way that we are accustomed to regard it as functioning. So you see, we have to bear in mind these facts when we consider meditation. What does meditation do? What is it supposed to do? Let me perhaps start off by saying how it functions. Remember that mind and consciousness are universals. They are not particulars. Mind and consciousness, like space, are universals. We never talk of my space, although nations talk in terms of their airspace and all the rest of the stuff, but they are talking through their hats, and that is why they end up with quarreling and fighting about the thing, you see. We can't say my space. You can't take hold of a bit of space. Space completely interpenetrates the organism, and it remains itself over and above. Similarly, with mind and consciousness, we cannot, with any accuracy, talk of my mind or my consciousness. When this primordial mind interacts with corporeality, the primordial matter, then, as manifested in creatures like ourselves, it raises up psyche, because this pure energy, this cosmic energy of mind, has its roots in the physical brain and nervous system, in the activity of the ductus glands, in the streaming of the blood, and the functioning of the senses. So we function as psychophysical individuals here and now in the manner in which we function. Our thinking, as we call it, how does it emerge? What do we mean by our thinking? All the stimuli that come to us through our senses reach the brain, and the brain synthesizes these, and with the help of the use of language, gives names to everything that comes to us through our senses. Gives names to them. And thus brings up language, and with language, the brain produces a meaningful pattern of words. A meaningful pattern of words. But its meaningfulness is restricted entirely to our finite, temporal, and mortal state and condition. It is entirely in the realm of mortality. So when we think, all that we do is to churn up the words that we know and the pictures that we experience. In fact, we churn up our sense experience, our sensuous life, our psychical life. We set that going as a current, and that is what we call our thinking. Now, when we talk, when people, religious people, talk about the thought of God or the mind of God, what actually happens in their own brains is that they are projecting what they know and experience onto something superhuman, something which is utterly beyond us, but which nevertheless bears all the traces of our limited humanity. This is where the trouble comes. They muddle up the context of the finite, the temporal, and the mortal with the context of the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal. They use words. People have used words like eternal, immortal, and infinite all through the ages, but they haven't the ghost of an idea. Well, they can't have an idea. They have no conscious experience of a reality which is infinite or eternal or immortal. But what we must remember is this, that the finite, temporal, and mortal is the embodiment of the infinite, the eternal, and the immortal. It is that which, differentiating and proliferating in terms of energy and consciousness, which has become all this, so that the Supreme Consciousness, the Absolute, is embodied in us and permeates in an imprisoned, in a locked up state, our whole psychophysical being. If that were not the case, there'd be no possibility of release from bondage to finitude and mortality into the eternal and the immortal. There'd be no possibility. You see, this is the reason why the Buddha said, monks, there is an unborn, unbecome, unmade, and you find this unbecome, this unborn spoken of in the Rig Veda through many hymns. In one of the footnotes in the Heart of Religion, I've given you all the references in the Rig Veda and the Atharva Veda where the unborn occurs, you see. If there were not this, there would be no release from this which is born, which is the become and the made. In other words, there would be no release out of the state of mortality and suffering and evil and so forth into the state of the absolute freedom of pure mind. You see? But it is helpful to try and understand what I have tried in my little way to present in terms of of getting some sort of feel about the transcendent. Because then we can appreciate how we must direct our effort. Now, the universals, mind and consciousness, like space, they function completely through each and every one of us, but we don't know it. When I say we don't know it, with our brain functioning, we don't know it with our brains. We may believe it blindly, but that is a belief as so many words. It's no fact. If the belief really corresponds to fact, we would be living that fact, and we would be that fact. Consciousness is everything that there is. Whatever you realize in innermost consciousness to the ultimate extent is something which naturally and spontaneously manifests itself through your entire life. So now these universals function through the psychophysical being. And our task as human beings, and at our present stage we are subhuman beings really, subhuman not in a pejorative sense, but in a factual sense. We have not yet come to our full flowering. We are not yet the perfect human, you see. In our subhuman state, we are unable to be awake to the fact that the universals function through us. And we are unable to be awake to that fact simply because our psyche is so full of so many obstructions which block the truth, the reality, from finally impressing the brain consciousness itself, consciousness in the brain itself. And our task is to release ourselves through the purification of the psyche from all these obstructions to transcendence. And then the human being has at last become the fully human, the perfected holy one. That is the true human being, no one else. Now, meditation is the movement of consciousness in its own transcendent sphere. Now, do you get it? That is what meditation is. It's the movement, I use the word movement meaning activity, meaning life. Life is movement, we say, obviously, isn't it? Activity implies movement. That's what I mean by movement. Not just movement in space and time, of an object moving at a certain speed through space. Not in that sense, but this sense of a living activity. This living activity is the important thing about the functioning of consciousness. When consciousness through us functions in its own transcendent sphere, then that is the meditative state. And that is where meditation in the supreme sense begins. This English word meditation is unfortunate. The dictionary meaning, and of course it's perfectly legitimate to use the dictionary meaning, because we use that language. And in that language, meditation means musing. Well, what is musing? You're chattering inside, silently inside your brains. That's all. Nothing else. You may make that chatter somewhat sublime, somewhat exalted, and very reverent, and all the rest of it, but it's just chatter. There is no potency in it. If there was potency in it, when you're talking silently in your brain, if you were to say, like in Genesis, God said, "Let there be light," and there was light, you could do that. But you see, it is impotent chatter. This is what our thinking is, impotent chatter. And it is completely subject to all our weaknesses and drawbacks. Our state of desire, which includes our greed and lusts for power, possessions and all the rest of it. It includes everything that comes under malevolence, ill will, hate, fear and violence. And it includes all our illusions and delusions. You see? That is what this chatter is about. And that is why it is impotent. That is why it is an obstruction to the power of transcendence itself, functioning freely through the living human being. Now, when the living human being has become utterly purified and free in his whole psychophysical organism, particularly in the psyche, of all the obstructions to that kind of transcendent consciousness functioning through him, the living organism, then there is true meditation. That's the beginning point of meditation. And that meditation takes place in the milieu of an awareness of totality. You are cosmically aware. Now, don't misunderstand this phrase. People have always thought that cosmic consciousness means that you know all about every single separate object and so forth throughout the cosmos. Nothing of the sort. It's all nonsense. So much nonsense has been talked about these things through the ages, East and West alike. It is not this. This is all wishful thinking and thinking born of ignorance. When there is this purification and you are in that state, then that is what the Christian mystics call the Unio Mystica. That is the state the Buddha refers to when he talks about entering the cessation, the complete stopping, the complete ending, not so much stopping, because that implies that you stop something. It's not that. It just naturally and spontaneously ends. It calms down. The stopping of all perception and feeling. The terms perception and feeling used not in our ordinary sense, but in a transcendental sense, in which you perceive and feel that which is quite beyond. And you can do it here and now yourselves too, when you are in a sufficiently harmonious state, which transcends the perceiving of ordinary mortals. And by ordinary mortals, I also include geniuses in this category. You see? All right. It's this ending of all perception and feeling. And in the Upanishads and the Hindu teachings, you get the state which is called the Turiya state. The fourth state, as they call it. The fourth avastha. Avastha, you see, the Turiya avastha. And in that Turiya avastha, transcendence, so to say, meets transcendence within you. Now, bear in mind what I said in the beginning, that everything is this primordial creative energy, this absolute consciousness embodied. It is embodied in us, it's locked up here. Our task as human beings, which animals and vegetables don't have to do, on certainly the earth and planets and so on, but our task is so to awake to this transcendence through the purification process, that we enable that supreme consciousness to manifest through us. You know, this was expressed in quite simple language. The very simplicity has been the source of its complete misunderstanding by the whole of Christendom. And Jesus said, I and the Father are one. I tell you what my Father tells me. Now you see, that language is very simple. It's poetic. It's emotionally attractive. But people misinterpret the meaning of it. What is the Father? Who is the Father? And so forth. You see? And what is the meaning of Abba in Chokhmah? My Father in heaven. Gott in Himmel, as we say in German. Eh? What is the meaning of that? It's something people just don't know anything about. So they let their fantasying make all sorts of illusory pictures of a transcendent reality. And this, in a sense, is a sinful act. To make illusory pictures of a transcendent reality. Because when one makes illusive pictures like that, they act as a force for making you live your daily life in this, that or the other way. And most of it is a confused and a muddled way, and where so many thousands of people are concerned, a thoroughly evil way. So we have to bear that in mind. So now the question arises, how do we live? What do we mean by religious living so that we can enter this Unio Mystica? I don't know whether that is the best way to put it. So that the Unio Mystica takes place through us. That is a better way of putting it. You have to put it as impersonally as possible. Otherwise, there is always the separation of the subject, I, and the other thing that has happened. That separation disappears. You see? All right. What is the way? Inside us, in the process of the differentiation of energy and the proliferation of consciousness, there is ingrained in our very structure, our psychophysical structure, there is a bridge Now, of course, be careful. When I say bridge, the brain immediately pictures. You can't avoid it. I couldn't avoid it when it first struck me that way. You immediately see a bridge, like the ordinary bridge which we know in physical life, you see. There is a bridge, a connecting link, a conduit, if you like, a way, if you like, by which the individual can step over, can cross over to, now again I'm going to use a phrase which has to be carefully understood, the other shore. The other shore is not other than this. It is here now. It is all this. You see, it's easy for me to talk like this because I'm free of the illusions which arise, the illusory pictures which arise through the use of words. That other shore includes this shore. It's all in here. Why? Simply because this is, as I've said time and again, the very embodiment of transcendence itself and the absolute consciousness. Therefore it is here. And because it is here, it is possible to move from here to here, from here now to here now, in order to come to fulfillment and fruition. Take a bud on a tree. It's there, here now. It opens out and becomes the flower here now. In the here now. You see? It is like that. And this is the marvel and the wonder of it all. And something which gives us the tremendous energy required to work in the right way towards this. In the right way. That means not with the not by putting that as a desirable goal, which will of course mean fulfillment and fruition and happiness and all the rest of it. All that is claptrap. Cut it out. But in order that the primordial purpose of this original creative activity may come to fruition, unto God the glory. For God's sake, become completely awake to that. Nothing for us. When you are really free of any the slightest trace of a desire for us, for myself, you see, when you're really free of that, then the right thing can happen by itself. Otherwise it will never happen right through your life. And it is so urgent now that this sort of thing should happen through individual human beings, the decent human beings that there still are on this globe. I mean, today mankind is not mankind, but anything but kind. Anything but kind. They are not children in the real sense. You have to become as a little child in order that the kingdom of heaven may take you into it. You see? It's like that. All right. So, let us first see how we function here as we are. As we are, even for our ordinary limited thinking processes and so on, we have to be observant. We have to be alert and sensitive to all the stimuli that come to us through our sense functions. And we have to be completely mindful of them, completely mindful. Now, to be observant means not only to be observant in the sense of I, the subject, observing that other thing, the object. When that other thing, the object, is observed by me, what is my brain doing? It's always talking back at it. If I see an apple tree, I immediately start saying, oh, it's not a very good tree, isn't that so? I cannot just shut my wretched mouth and really look. Look with complete attentiveness. This is where the concentration part of mental training comes in. Look with complete attentiveness. And as a result of that complete attentiveness, the isolative effect of one's own self-consciousness subsides altogether. And then when you see a wall, you'll not only see a wall, but you will actually see and experience the wall-ness of that wall. You'll experience the rose-ness of the rose, the apple-ness of the apple when you eat it. If you eat it with such perfect attention, that's what you will experience actually, you see. That means that there is a real at-one-ment, a true unity between oneself and that which you are eating or looking at and so forth. You see? Now, why does the brain keep chattering in the ordinary way? Why does it keep chattering at everything? Because it is conditioned. It is conditioned from the word, from the moment we are born onwards. It is conditioned. And all that conditioning falsifies the truth, the transcendent reality of all that we experience through our senses. It negates it actually, you see, all that conditioning. Now we can't say, oh, we can't sort of go through a psychoanalytical process and discover, oh, I'm conditioned this way, this way, this way, now I'll do this, that and the other in order to get rid of that conditioning. You won't do anything of the sort. Nothing like that can be done. Just observe and just accept the totality of the universe, which is your personal experience. Just look at it, and you will find that in the complete looking, without any sort of selfness operating there, and listening, and tasting, and touching, without any sort of selfness there, the transformation of the whole consciousness within oneself takes place. One's mode of awareness undergoes this transmutation by which the transcendent reality itself functions freely through you now. It is already locked up in you, but it will open out and function freely. When the temple is absolutely clean and pure, then the Lord comes into his own. It is like that, you see. So now that is the condition of meditation. What happens there, I cannot possibly tell you, because it's utterly beyond the scope of concepts and words. But it will happen. And that is the real knowing, if you like. Not in our ordinary sense of the word knowing. Knowing that 2 plus 2 equals almost 4. Not in that sense. But the transcendent knowing is actually being the transcendence yourself. And that is the real meditative state.